Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome to Richard Rossi Live. We have one of Hollywood's hot young directors coming on in just a moment, Mark Freiberger. And don't miss this wonderful 29 minutes. We'll be talking about a lot of exciting things. Mark won the Doritos competition, Super Bowl competition, best commercial, was voted in a CBS poll the best Super Bowl commercial ever of all time. And he's also a great feature film director. Back with Mark Freiberger in just a few moments, so don't go away. You're going to enjoy it. Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live, and without any further delay, Mark Freiberger, I'm so happy to have you on the show, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me, Richard. I appreciate it.
I first discovered Mark's film Dog Days. In fact, I think I went with Josie Pollock, a friend of ours, to the premiere, my wife Sherry and Josie, and Josie's been on the show. Wasn't it the Lemley in Los Angeles Dog Days? I think it was, wasn't it?
I believe so. I believe it was one of the Lemley theaters on Wilshire.
Yeah, that's my recollection. Yeah. And I was just amazed at this film. I mean, you were very young when making your first feature. Weren't you early 20s, mid-20s?
I was. It was actually it was crazy. I was 22. I turned 22 while we started shooting that movie. And I think I bit off a little bit more than I could chew at that age. And spent kind of the next year, in production on that and then in post and then trying to figure out what I was really doing and trying to figure out how to sell a movie, which was a whole new education in itself. So don't think I would recommend to many people to tackle your first film at that age, but in the end it worked out all right.
Mm. And you were right out of school, I think. Had you by that point graduated from University of North Carolina School of the Arts? You just graduated probably, what, like 6 months, a year prior?
Yeah, actually, we started shooting the movie in August of 2005, and I had just graduated in June 2005. So I had only been out of school for 2 months, and the crew was mainly made up of all film students at the time and recent graduates. I kind of took a page from a director that I admired who came out of our school about 10 years before me by the name of David Gordon Green, who's gone on to make a lot of great indies and studio films. And he'd made a film relatively early coming out of the School of the Arts and shot it in Winston-Salem, where we went to school. And it was crewed up by a bunch of sort of current students and recent graduates and everybody just kind of getting together for the same goal, and I wanted to do something similar. And so kind of my last year of school, and really kind of my last 2 years of school, I've been sort of planning to do a feature. And then in my last year, I got together with two writers who, in my opinion, were, the best writers in our program, who've now gone on to do wonderful things. One of those writers is Chris Wailed, who is a series writer and producer on the show NCIS, and then the other writer was a guy by the name of Travis Beecham, who wrote the big movie Pacific Rim that came out last year, and he also wrote Clash of the Titans, the version that came out about 3 or 4 years, I believe, 3 or 4 years ago. So, I got these guys and got together with them who, we were all fourth-year students at the time, gave them. I had had sort of semblance of a story that I wanted to make, and they took it and wrote it into a really nice script. It was a very, looking back, kind of a strange little movie, But it was a nice little script. And then I spent the rest of my fourth year just kind of raising money and listening to my faculty on how to build a business plan. We were ready to go that summer when I got out of school and kind of never looked back since. It's been a lot of up and down since, more downs than ups, but I think that's the way things go, especially in the indie world. But
so this was, making this film in a way was kind of like your second film school,
absolutely.
Yeah, you got your bachelor's in, was it directing or film? And then this was like a film school in the real world, which the things they don't teach you in film school probably of just going out and how to do, and stepping out in faith and doing it, huh?
Absolutely. It was it really was my second film school, if not my real film school, you know. I think every filmmaker who steps out and makes their first feature, as you know, really understands that being the actual schooling. And yeah, I still look back and just think I was nuts. You know, done that, but very, very, very thankful that it did get made, and that we did get the film out there. And it's fun, you know. People still discover the film on Netflix all the time. I had somebody tell me earlier this week, a Brazilian guy actually, tell me that he saw my film on Netflix about 3 months ago.
And that is cool.
It was cool. Yeah, we had got connected with this local producer here in town, and they introduced me to someone, and the guy said, why does your film sound familiar? And he said, oh, and he looked it up. He said, oh, I watched this on Netflix about 3 months ago. And it's just kind of, you know, it's nice that it's out there and that people still find it, and every once in a while I get a nice email from somebody saying, oh, this was a really nice little film. I wish I had heard of it.
Yeah. It had a nostalgic feeling to me. Very, very. Was that kind of the feeling for you? Was a feeling for me of childhood nostalgia?
Absolutely. With the writers, we talked a lot about sort of our influences ranging from, you know, Frank Capra to Ray Bradbury, and so it's got mixtures of all those elements in it. And it is, you know, it's sort of a film that at its core was kind of about reconnecting with your childlike faith. And, you know, for those that haven't seen the film, it sort of follows the main character who's returning to this small southern town that he grew up in, and the town is about to be flooded the next day, and so it's completely abandoned. And he steps into this town with the hope of finding something that he lost that summer, that he was a boy this summer, that where his innocence was lost. And so he's spending this day, the last day that the town is in physical existence, walking around the town looking for that thing that he lost. And while he's walking around, we tell the story of the summer that changed his life and the summer that changed the life of the town forever in a series of flashbacks. And we shot all those scenes where the main character is wandering around the town. We shot all those scenes in the winter later at the end of 2005, early 2006, so that the film has a very different aesthetic look to it, you know, so sort of the present day, sort of future, is very cold and very stark, versus sort of, you know, the warm, nostalgic effect that we went for when we tell the flashbacks in the story. So the funny thing that most people don't know is we didn't originally intend it to be that way. We were planning on shooting it as you do with a movie all at once, but certain conflicts arose, and so, you know, I just decided to cut off a portion of the filming and come back months later, you know, when we would have a better look anyway.
Well, I'm glad you made it, because I think that's how we got to Italy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
for those of our listeners, Mark and I had films, Dog Days and my film Sister Amy, up for awards in Italy, Milan, Italy Film Festival, and we got to go to Italy together along with your talented DP, Rob Givens.
Yeah, and that was such a fantastic trip, and the festival was a lot of fun, and was not expecting there to be that many people at the award ceremony. They held the award ceremony in indoor soccer arena.
Oh, yes. That was a surprise. Yeah. It was such a big event.
Still one of those moments where I realized I need to take some public speaking classes, because when we won and I went up to accept the award, I just looked out over the 2,000 faces, however many people there were there, and just froze and had no idea what to say. So I remember just nodding and then taking the award and walking away. And then everybody started the slow clap. So.
Well, I'm sorry, too, that I made you smoke that horrible raunchy cigar in Florence.
I know. It's okay. It's all right.
Wow, beautiful people, molto bene. And then your most recent dramatic film, Jimmy, very moving film. I really liked the relationship in this film, Jimmy, with the boy who's mentally disabled and his grandfather. To me, that was like the core, the fulcrum that really made that film.
Yeah, that's by far, the best relationship in the film. And the feedback that we've got from audiences is the same thing, you know, that people really love the relationship between those two characters, and it's just so pure. For those of you that have never heard of the film, the film is called Jimmy, and it's about a mentally challenged boy who interacts with angels, and he's got this relationship with his grandfather in the story, who really is sort of the character that believes in him more than anybody else, and just wonderful that role, the grandfather role, is played by Ted Levine, who I think most people know from this TV series Monk, but he's also had some pretty iconic roles, like he played Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs, which is a very different role than the one he played.
Yeah, that's pretty scary.
Yeah, and then the boy that we found to play Jimmy is just absolutely phenomenal, a young actor by the name of Ian Colletti. He's out of New York, but he's actually here in L.A. right now shooting the TV series Rake. He plays Greg Kinnear's son on that show.
That was the best performance I've seen of a young, mentally challenged man since Leo DiCaprio and Gilbert Grape. I haven't seen anybody do it on that level since, and Ian pulled it off.
He really knocked it out of the park. It's funny, Ian jokes now that he peaked at age 14 with that role. He's like, I'll never get a role as good as that again.
Well, that's a compliment to you guys.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I'm sure he's got a lot of good years ahead of him, and I'm sure he'll get some great roles. But he was fantastic to work with. And, oddly enough, we saw when we set out to make that film, we pretty much saw every kid in the age range in Hollywood that wasn't working at that time that was available during the time.
Wow, a lot of talented young actors you saw, huh?
Yeah, and a lot of kids with a lot of great credits, but no one could just quite pull off that role, the way Ian did. And
so did you give him a really challenging scene where, like the sides of maybe showing his disability, his frustration, something that would really challenge them in the audition, I guess, huh?
We did, yeah. And then we gave him some scenes that weren't very emotionally challenging, but we gave him also the most difficult scenes. And the interesting thing about him is that he was, I never saw him in person. I saw his audition tape, and then my callback with him was on Skype. And so
really? Wow.
He got on his computer at home in New York, and then I was here in L.A., and sat on Skype on the other end here in L.A. with our casting director, and he auditioned again for us, and we gave him some notes, and then he did the scenes again, and he just knocked it out of the park.
What a wonderful young guy, and I can tell he's just a decent guy. He has the right heart. He has a good heart. The spiritual nature of the story, I think, is authentic from him.
Yeah, I think it really is too. I think that he was born to play that role, I think it's something that kind of there were just a lot of things that I guess you could say were not coincidences. Even down the fact that like he spent a lot of time growing up as a kid, like even working with mentally challenged and autistic children.
So he had a lot to draw from real life.
Yeah.
Because I felt that in his performance. I could see he might have maybe watched Leo in the sense of looking at someone else that took on the same challenge as an actor, but it was grounded in real life because I think a really good actor has to imitate life and not just imitate art. And he had that experience with those kids to draw on in his memory bank.
Absolutely. And I think it served him well. And since he's not a well-known actor at this time, we got, I think, some of the greatest compliments that came, especially after a lot of the screenings, is people would say, how did you find a mentally challenged boy that could act? And he said, no, he's just an actor.
That is a compliment.
Yeah. There was a film that I was going to make last year that got canceled in the 11th hour, but we had potentially talked about bringing on Ian to play the lead in that, when we were casting, and we sent the film Jimmy to young actress here that was playing, we were sort of courting to play the lead in that film, and she watched it and thought 100% she thought that he was mentally challenged, and she said she had to look him up just to double check and make sure that, you know, he actually wasn't. And yeah, he amazed me in that. So, you know, I think that if you guys get a chance to check out that film, it's out on DVD various places now, and I believe later this year we'll expand even more. I don't think you can get a Redbox, but it's not on instant streaming on Netflix at the moment, but you can get it on DVD from Netflix and a ton of other places online. But
yeah, Amazon has both Dog Days and Jimmy, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Dog Days of Summer and Jimmy. And so here you were, you made these two features, and all of a sudden you go from thousands to millions with this Doritos contest. Some of you listening out there that are filmmakers have probably aware of this contest or thought about entering this contest, the Doritos Super Bowl contest, best commercial. And lo and behold, Mark and some of our some friends that have been compatriots of his, they got together and they made this fantastic commercial. I love the relationship with the dad and the little girl. You know, it seems like all your stuff has a great relationship at its core. And, wow, I mean, when you won that contest, did you feel like all of a sudden you'd gone from, like, you know, the minor leagues to the majors in terms of now, what were you feeling? I mean, here you now know that millions of people are seeing your work.
Mm-hmm. It was a very bizarre feeling. You know, I think, you know, the moment the commercial aired, you know, just to begin, it was a very surreal moment. And then, you know, my phone, I think I received like 200-something text messages and phone calls within 5 minutes. And, you know, I remember, you know, Michael Bay, who was a part of the contest that year, last year, was at the Super Bowl with us. And I remember holding up my phone and showing it to him when it had all the, you know, 200-plus, you know, text message things just kept dinging, like, and going higher and higher, and he was just like, I've never seen anything like that in my life. And I was excited.
Wow.
I was like, wow, I've shown Michael Bay something he hasn't seen before, you know.
Oh, that's pretty amazing. A guy that's making big-budget films, and you're blowing him away with the response.
Yeah, so it was just, you know, it's a testament to how, I think, excited everybody was that had been rooting for us for so long, you know, there were so many people that came to our aid to help us vote, you know, and all our friends that were involved in making that. It was such a community experience, you know, it was such a bizarre feeling seeing that air, and then all the publicity that surrounded it, and sort of the opportunities that have come about since, it's definitely been sort of a wonderful thing to happen. You know, the irony is that, you know, it was a commercial. It was a spec commercial. We made it on our own at home, and, you know, it was a $300 ad. And, you know, I'd made two dramatic 90-minute movies before this that, you know, really very limited people have ever seen. And then all of a sudden we made a goofy little 30-second spot for $300, and the whole world saw it. It was such a strange feeling, and it just goes to show you never know what's going to be that thing that sort of tips the scales for you.
Yeah, that's true. And you're not aware sometimes what the iconic thing's going to be, are you, that's going to really open the door.
Right. I love the irony of, you know, we spent about $300 to make that commercial, and Doritos spent almost $4 million to air at once during the game. You know, they aired a lot now, you know, on cable and you know, a lot of different networks. But just the, you know, it was mind-boggling how much a Super Bowl ad goes for at the
Did you say 40 million or
about four?
$4 million.
Four.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe it was like 3.8 or 4 at the time last year to have a 30-second spot.
And it was ranked by CBS the best commercial of all time, greatest Super Bowl commercial of all time.
Yeah, it's crazy. I can't say that I actually agree with that personally, but I'll take it, you know. I think nonetheless it's pretty cool. But Yeah, they did a few weeks ago. They did this top 10 countdown of the top 10 greatest Super Bowl commercials of all time, and it kept counting down and counting down. And then number two was there was a Pepsi ad from the 1990s, and then it got to number one, and all of a sudden, once again, it was like I started getting all these phone calls, and Doritos, some of the executives at Doritos called me, and they all started screaming on the phone. I was like, what, what's going on?
That's so cool.
Like, yeah, we were just about the greatest commercial of all time. Bye.
And speaking as a dad, I totally relate to the way this little princess daughter suckers, bribes dad with the Doritos and gets him to dress up like a princess, and his buddies dress up like princess in it. You know, it really resonates, and I think it shows, did it show you that, you know, you don't need 90 minutes, you can tell, if you know what you're doing, if you're effective, if you think it through, you can tell a really effective story in that shortened form. I mean, was that a challenge to you as a feature filmmaker to adjust to, I only got, you know, what was it, 30
yeah,
seconds?
30 or? Seconds, yeah. It was a challenge because, you know, also having come from made, you know, I've done a lot of little comedy things before, but having made two dramatic features before this, you know, I like to, like, let my scenes breathe, and I don't like a lot of fast cuts, but in commercials, you know, you've got to move, and you can't waste a frame because you only have 30 seconds to tell a story and 30 seconds to get a message across and to sell a product. And so I believe we had 26 cuts within the 30 seconds, which is, you know, basically about a second, 1.2 or whatever that is, 1.1 seconds per cut, which I'm not used to. And I remember on our first cut, you know, of the 30-second spot, I believe we had about 19 cuts in there, and it just felt like we were cutting too much and too fast. But that's just the way it is. Yeah, so, you know, working in that format was new to me, but I really, really enjoyed it, and it's a wonderful challenge trying to figure out how to tell a story in 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, you did it, and as part of the prize, you shadowed Michael Bay on Transformers 4, right?
I did, and I think that to this day has been my greatest experience of my career so far, even more so than making my own films. I learned a tremendous amount on that film, and you know, forever grateful to Michael Bay for bringing me along on that journey. And you know, he took it very seriously. I wasn't sure what to expect going in, you know, I think as a lot of people in this industry, you hear stories, you know, about certain folks and who they may or may not be. But I mean, he was wonderful, and he, you know, he gave me a lot to do on set. He stopped and listened. He, you know, when I had questions, he let me shadow him, and I spent a lot of time just close to him, and sort of in his circle, getting to experience everything firsthand, you know, from his point of view. And you know, he seemed to really enjoy having me there, and I learned so much just from him and from the people in his circle. You know, he really has the, you know, I believe the best teams in the world working for him, from the producers, you know, script supervisors, sound mixers, the camera team, and everybody on that set. You know, this was on the Transformers 4, the new Transformers Age of Extinction, and everybody on that set was willing to stop and share their wisdom with me, you know. It was just a phenomenal experience. I was on the film for almost 3 months, and we shot in Chicago. The film shot all over, from Texas and Detroit, Chicago and Hong Kong. But I was there mostly for the for all of the Chicago and Hong Kong portions, and just a phenomenal experience, and what a crash course in big budget sort of tentpole filmmaking as well.
What surprised you about Michael Bay and his process, and, you know, what it was like on set with him? As you say, you know, a person at that level, you hear a lot of stories, and everyone has their opinions. But what about the way he worked was surprised you, or maybe was there anything that you took away that was like not what you thought it would be?
Yeah, I think I was most impressed with first off, I've got to say, you know, I've been on this quite a few sets that are not just my own. Never at this level where I've been able to sort of stay that long, you know, but I've visited sets before and seen some great directors work, and then seen a lot of friends that, you know, have been directing their own indies or directing television. Got a chance to just kind of spend the day, you know, witness. But the one thing about Michael that I've never seen from any others is that he is the hardest working director I've ever seen on a set. I mean, he goes nonstop from the moment he arrives. He is moving and moving and moving. And I think the thing that impressed me the most with that was that his decision-making skills were so clear and he was so fast to make a decision. You know, on an indie film, I think on my greatest days, you know, say we shoot maybe 5-6 pages a day, which is kind of average for an indie. And on a really good day, if you don't have a lot of lighting, maybe you can get 20 camera setups in a day, maybe, you know. And a lot of times in studio films, from what I hear, sort of getting a lot of directors are getting 10 setups or under in a day. Some directors maybe just 2, 3, 4, 5, depending on how extensive the scene was. But here we were on Transformers and doing heavy visual effect shots, a lot of technical things to consider, mixed in with actors running all over the screen, dialogue, everything you can imagine, buses blowing up, you know, practically on set, all kinds of things, fire, explosions. And Michael would average between 20, 30, 40 setups a day, which was just mind-blowing. And
wow.
It was from, I was so impressed by how as soon as he'd call cut, he would know exactly if he got the shot that he needed or not, and then he was marching on to the next setup. And, you know, the crew works really, really hard, but everybody, it's such a fun set to be on. And I talked to a lot of, like, crew members that have worked for him for years, and you know, they said that his movies are their favorite to work on because it's fast-paced, it's exciting, and, you know, every day you're basically at a new location. And and unlike a lot of directors now, he's still, a lot of his action sequences are done practically on set. The crashes, the explosions, things like that are all done practically, and then they just use visual effects to enhance those things. Of course, the robots in these movies are all visual effects, but... you know, there's a lot of directors now where the entire scene is just shot in the green screen studio, and everything's, you know, everything's visual effects. But on these films, there so much of it is practical, which is why they look so good.
Wow. I wonder if his background, I think, started in music videos, didn't it?
Yeah.
I wonder if that's part of his ability to just really rock and roll and keep that pace. And
I think so, yeah. And he was definitely one of the biggest commercial directors in the 90s.
Yeah.
I think I don't think a lot of people know this, but he directed that that Got Milk spot that was real popular in the 90s. The one where the guy, the Aaron Burr spot, where the guy is sitting in a museum and the museum, the Alexander Hamilton Museum, and they're asking, you know, for the $10,000 question, who shot Alexander Hamilton? And it was a great spot.
I think I could be wrong, but I think he also cut his teeth on some of the. On some of the great music videos like Michael Jackson and others that I think there were some of the great music videos, and I think even some of the pop, Donny Osmond, certain stars that he, before he was known, I'm pretty sure he was.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at his credits because he probably did do music videos as well, because I know that he and a group of other directors back in the 90s had propaganda films like him and David Fincher, and they all kind of, I guess they owned that company together or something, and it was just... music videos and commercials.
Wow. Well, you know, time flies when you're having fun. They're giving me the signal here. What a blessing to visit with such a talented director. Mark Freiberger is represented by the Gotham Group. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah.
It's a good group because Batman lives in Gotham City.
Exactly.
And you have a new project just announced in Variety. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yeah.
You've done things on Nickelodeon, so much more. IMDb Mark for more of his credits. And what's the best way for people to get in touch with you? Would Twitter, or how would you recommend they contact you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Real Freiberger, because someone took Mark Freiberger. So.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Real Freiberger, Freiberger, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter.
And Burger and Fries. Have they said that? Burger and Fries?
All the time.
So that they know to say Freiburger instead of Freeburger.
Exactly.
Burger and Fries.
Exactly.
I just realized that after all these years and a trip to Italy, and I finally just figured that out.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I am just so thrilled. They're telling me I'm out of time, but thank you so much for coming on, Mark.
I really appreciate you having me. This was fun. Thank you.
And I'm going to ask Grace from Blog Talk Radio for a couple extra seconds to announce upcoming shows. Tomorrow morning, tomorrow, Wednesday, March 5th, 11 a.m. Pacific time, Frank Schaefer. Frank Schaefer is a filmmaker, artist, novelist, best-selling New York Times best-selling writer. His father, Francis Schaefer, and Frank were kind of catalysts with the whole religious right way back in the days of Jerry Falwell. And he has since recanted a lot of that as a misrepresentation of Christ. And I'm so thrilled that Frank's going to be on the show tomorrow. Also, for you Family Affair fans, the great 60s show Family Affair, on Friday, 10:30 a.m., we have Kathy Garver, who played Sissy on that show. You remember her? I remember seeing her on that show when I was a kid and thinking, what a doll. She's going to be here 10:30 a.m. Friday. We have an Oscar winner coming on Saturday, 2:30 p.m., Kevin Klauber, who edited 20 Feet from Stardom. And we were screaming and yelling. We were so excited when Kevin in the film won at the Oscars. It was my birthday Sunday, and we were at a restaurant we're just celebrating. I was just, please God, let him win, and he won. I'm just so thrilled. Next week, real quick, we have John Putsch, director of many TV shows and films, son of the iconic actress from All in the Family that played Edith Bunker, Gene Stapleton's son, and a very talented director, and we have a Pennsylvania connection together. And next Friday, 11 a.m., director Kevin Miller. Next Thursday, the 13th, 10 a.m., we have the author of several of the great Pittsburgh Steeler Glory Days books, Dale Gridnick, and director Darla Ray, next Sunday, 11:30. Well, just go to blogtalkradio.com/Richard Rossi and get all the future shows there. And follow us. Just click follow, and you'll get notifications. Anyways, I'm way out of time, but what a great show. And continue to follow Mark Freiburger on Twitter. And God bless you until tomorrow morning with Frank Schaefer.